This week, a special episode about the Dionysian artificers, artists, architects. Which is it? In a Masonic first, we travel back hundreds of years to set a record straight. What is the Masonic connection to these so-called Dionysian or Dionysic architects? The answer will surprise you, but how we got there is no surprise at all. In this extended Masonic Mythbusters episode, Worshipful Brother Day doesn't disappoint. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode 632. This week, I've got an amazing episode of Masonic Mythbusters. Now, in fact, I've been holding on to this episode for quite a while. In fact, you could call me somewhat of a gatekeeper of this particular story. Brother Patrick in the past had asked me, hey, would you like me to record a piece that is a little bit longer to help you out on weeks where it's difficult to do a recording because you're super busy? And I was very grateful. And he sent me this piece and I loved it. It's a whole episode long, and I think you're going to love it. But I held on to it until I needed it. And I needed it this time around. So I'm opening the gates, as it were, to the true story behind the Dionysian artists and what would later become the Dionysian architects. So without further ado, here is Worshipful Brother Day with this special extended edition of Masonic Mythbusters.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
Freemasons have an obsession with trying to prove that the fraternity is anything older than a 300-year-old boys' club. Sure, it has earlier precedents and that it grew out of the operative stonemason guilds of the Middle Ages, but it certainly does not date back to the pyramids of Giza, much less Adam's fig leaf. Something I always thought was weird, because the fig leaf was a mark of shame, so does that mean our aprons are a mark of shame? Anyway, I digress. One example Masons have used to try and prove Masonry's great antiquity is the Dionysiac Architects, a purportedly ancient order of architects devoted to Dionysus, who, according to Masonic scholars, air quotes there, they were the predecessors to modern-day Freemasonry. Now, the first time I heard about these Dionysiac architects was sometime in 2013, mentioned in a passing reference in some really out-there esoteric presentation that not even I could follow. And I get pretty out there. I immediately thought, who the hell are the Dionysiac architects? I've never heard of such a thing, and truth be told, it seems weird. Masonry came out of a group of architects devoted to the drunken, debauched god of wine. I couldn't even pay attention to the rest of the presentation because it seemed so perplexing. And then when I got home, I tried to look them up and, surprise, surprise, all I could find were references to them in Manly P. Hall's Secret Teachings of All Ages. Truth be told, I initially presumed they were something that Manly Hall just made up. However, as is more Hall's style, Hall is taking something he learned a little bit about and just running with it. We can actually trace where Hall is getting his info on these Dionysiac architects, as well as where his sources got their information, and so forth. Now, I know my usual style is to analyze the evolution and transmission of ideas and symbols. It's usually to jump around between the ideas themselves. However, here I will be taking a more linear approach, a much more materialistic, historiographical approach as initially outlined by Friedrich Engels, This is a materialistic approach to history and legendary, from historical attestation to proto-Masonic ideologies, essentially following a chain of corruption of the ideas. I will start with the oldest sources and work my way up to Manly Hall and how the Dionysiac artist became the Dionysiac architects. Now, the Dionysiac artists are a real group that is mentioned in two classical texts, Strabo's Geography and Aulus Gellius's Attic Nights. Now, both of these authors have been known throughout the last 2,000 years. However, their descriptions of the Dionysiac artist were only recently more heavily considered in the 18th century with the archaeological discoveries of Edmund Chisel and subsequent writers by Richard Chandler, Nicholas Revitt, and William Parse. This is where the corruption of the Dionysiac artist into the architects begins. So let's start at the beginning. Strabo was a geographer and a philosopher living through the turn of the Common Era. He gives a brief description of an itinerant group of entertainers known as the Dionysiac artists who moved about the Ionian coast of western Turkey. Strabo tells us that they traveled as far as Hellespont, which is the modern-day Dardanelles, a strait in northwest Turkey. But they originally inhabited Teos and then relocated to Ephesus after an incident of sedition. Next, Strabo tells us that King Attalus I of Pergamum would relocate them to Myonesis, which is between Teos and Lebedos. Then they would later move to Lebedos itself. All these cities are about 50 miles from each other. That's it. That's all we have from Strabo. But actually, we can surmise a few things from Strabo. Firstly, they were a traveling band of entertainers. That's not so unusual. Think of them like a rock band. They're from a certain town, but they tour around various cities to bring the same show to a new audience, as opposed to having to create a new show to the same audience in the same town night after night. It's a matter of logistics. It's not that special that they moved around. So next comes Aulus Gellius, who was a Roman author that wrote about everyday things he encountered while living in the Attic region of mainland Greece. This work is immensely important because it provides commonplace philosophies and ideologies in everyday context, giving us a more accurate idea of what everyday people believed and practiced outside of whatever priests and sacred texts and philosophers like Plato had to say about things. Now, the eighth book of the Attic Nights is lost, with only the index surviving. Chapter 11 of Book 8 mentions a Dionysiac festival in the index, and this is important to note because later, as we will discuss, this section would be cited by a Masonic author with no information to support his claim. Now, Book 20, Chapter 4 of Attic Nights provides some more commonplace perceptions of the Dionysiac artist. In this section, Aulus Gellius tells us of a young man, a student of Lucius Calvinus Taurus, who was a Middle Platonist philosopher. This student of his admires the Dionysiac artist. Lucius tries to dissuade his student from following them and encourages him to read some of Aristotle, which is probably on interpretation by Aristotle. Now, he tries to show his pupil that the Dionysiac artists are intemperate. That is, they are drunk, gluttonous, and sexually promiscuous, and they are unenlightened, and that their general waywardness and impoverishment is the way to wickedness. Now, this section points to the Dionysiac artists as being corrupting to the youth, and a rather immoral group. Then there's really nothing on the Dionysiac artists until the antiquities boom of the 17th and 18th centuries. One antiquarian, Edmund Chisel, who traveled about Turkey and Greece hunting down inscriptions on fragments from the ancient world, many of these fragments he would transcribe and translate. Many of them were found on the backs of gravestones, various stelae, used in the constructing of walls, etc. indicating that these stone fragments were not valuable to later cultures, but their material value was useful for other purposes. One fragment Chisholm transcribes and translates is a Tayin fragment that contains a petition to Praetor Alexander of Caledonia. That is, he's Scottish, who is representing the council of all of Aetolia. Now, the fragment was found on the back of a gravestone in Sifrihisar, which is central Turkey. The petition asked that the occupying Romans to honor an old law that was agreed upon before the Roman occupation of Ionia. It states that the city of Teos and the region around it is sacred, that it should remain inviolable, and that the Aetolians have a right to asylum of this area, that Teos is not to be seized, and its inhabitants are not to be accosted, and that their right to wine and devotions to Dionysius are to be upheld. Toward the end of this fragment, the Dionysiac artists are mentioned to be part of this law to be observed. As noted, Chisholm translates the name into Latin as Dionysiacis Aetolorium, or the Dionysiacs of Aetolia. But the original Greek transcribes as a Dionysiakois Technetais, or the Dionysiac artist. In a footnote to this passage, Chisholm describes the group as relying on Aulus Gellius. He describes them as artists of comedy and tragedy, as well as of the flute, who were devoted to the god Dionysus, the inventor of the theater. He further states that cities agreed to pay them for their theatrical entertainment and games. Next, Chisholm relies on Strabo. He tells how they moved from Teos to Lebedos for security from the Aetolians. Now, based on the context of this Tayin fragment, against the mention of sedition in Strabo's geography, and the immorality in Aulus Gellius, Chisholm hints that he believes it was the Dionysiac artists themselves that caused the sedition. Richard Chandler would support this and state it in more in full that they indeed caused the sedition and they had to flee because it failed. Now, Chandler outlines the situation thusly. The turbulent behavior of the Dionysiac artists in Teos caused them to be expelled, likely at the behest of the Aetolians, that is, Athenians living in Teos. And thus, they relocated to Ephesus, but Attalus I, who favored this group, relocated them to Myonesius. Then, when the Romans came to rule Ionia, the Teians requested the Romans to not permit the Dionysiac artists to fortify Myonesius. And this petition appears to have been granted, as the group would then be relocated to Lebedos. I suppose here we probably need some historical backstory. Now, at the time, Philip V of Macedonia had allied with Hannibal to further expand into Anatolia, that is, Turkey. The Aetolian League and the Roman Navy would defeat them in 215 BCE. Attalus I of Pergamon allied with the Rhodians, and they would convince Rome to wage war against Macedon to secure autonomy for Greeks in Anatolia, albeit they would be under Roman rule. And an allegiance was made, and they defeated Philip V in 197 BCE at the Battle of Cynocephali. Under this agreement, the Aetolian League would acquire the spoils of war from Philip V's army. Of course, all of this is a great oversimplification of a complex system of alliances and battles, but it illustrates how an agreement was made to allow the Aetolians from mainland Greece to be given asylum in Anatolia, and the protection of certain cities like Teos, which was sacred to Dionysus. The other fragment, which was found on a stone built into a wall that Chisholm transcribes and translates, largely concerns the Attalians, that is, those who are loyal to King Attalus I, and the laws extended to them in their favor. It describes Attalus as the first's favor toward the Dionysiac artists, the protection offered to them and the citizens of Teos, as well as the copious offerings to be left at the theater for Dionysus. The decree and the fragment date to about 152 BCE. This fragment goes on to describe the diversity of groups in Teos, namely two competing factions, the Commune Attalistara, which is the common of the followers of Attalus the First, and the Commune Soliditi ab Echinodicti, the common confraternity from the talking hedgehog, or the talking urchin. Echinus is a strange term. It means both hedgehog and urchin, which really it's just describing the spiny, pointy back of both creatures. Now, Echinus is also a term used to describe the deep grooves in archaic Doric columns, because if you take a cross-section through an archaic Doric capital, it looks like spines of an urchin. Thus, the Society of the Talking Urchin may refer to a Dorian ethnic group, such as the Aetolians. Now, Chandler would later publish his notes and journal entries while investigating Chisholm's work, and would describe a Tahian fragment in the Wall of House in Sipra Hisar, which mentions two competing factions called the Panathenaeist and the Dionysiast. Now, the former are Athenians that had seized Teos, while the latter are, quote, contractors for the Asiatic theaters. These may be aliases for the two factions mentioned by Chisholm. Whatever the legal or common name of the Dionysiac artist was, be it the common of the followers of Attalus the First, or the Dionysius, or the Dionysiac artist, their group appears to have had some rituals. Now, based on Chandler's notes of his investigations, they held an annual general assembly in which sacrifices were made, libations were poured for deceased members and benefactors, and they held games in honor of Dionysus. Some of these offerings may be by the same decree to be offered to Dionysus by Attalus the First. Now, further, Chandler would state that these assemblies were presided over by a president, and that the meetings were filled with pomp and festivity, and were believed to have been conducted at the temple of Dionysus at Teos. It's difficult to know where Chandler is syncretizing information or elaborating, or if some of this information is new material he discovered. These details probably seem to you superfluous, but they are items that would be taken out of context by later Masonic authors to argue invalid points. One in particular would be when Chisholm states, "utensils and equipment of the Attalians," which will be used to argue that the Dionysiac artists used Masonic signs and implements, when in fact Chisholm simply means other tablets and writings that support the information he's translating. Now, further, it's difficult to know what fragments Chandler is examining, and to distinguish between him using more modern concepts and terms in lieu of historical contextualizing how these ancient organizations operated. Regardless, many of these things will be taken vastly out of context to support the Dionysiac artists as being a proto-Masonic order. Chisholm's work, Antiquitates Asiaticae, it's never been translated into English. It is interlinear Greek transcriptions with Latin translations. Thus, access to his work and understanding of it will rely on other scholars to provide commentary on his scholastic efforts. This is where Chandler, Revit, and Parse come in. With funding from the London Society of Dilettanti, these antiquarians would revisit a lot of Chisholm's work, give synopses, and provide commentary from their own work. This will, of course, lead to future problems and misunderstandings that get passed along as fact. For instance, where Dionysion Technaton had long been translated as Dionysiac Artis, the term tecton is variously translated as carpenter, builder, creator, et al. Chandler and others would translate this term as Dionysiac artificers. based on a description of them being favored and relocated by King Attalus I. Chandler would state that they were, quote, incorporated by the king and, quote, contracted to work at the theaters in Taos and throughout the region. This is an attempt by Chandler to contextualize it, albeit poorly, what something like this act by Attalus for the Dionysiac artists would look like today. That is, incorporation and contract work. These are modern capitalistic concepts being imposed on ancient cultures and do not properly represent the actions of King Attalus. We really should think of it more as providing asylum and permitting to conduct theatrical work under monarchical authority. These terms, being provided by Chandler and others, would be taken out of context by later Masons. One thing curiously ignored by later Masonic authors that relied on these texts is that one surviving fragment discovered by Chandler is a pedestal for the statue of Claudia Tryphaena, who was a high priestess of the goddess Asia, and she was a priestess of Dionysus. It does not suit the argument that the Dionysiac artists were a proto-Masonic organization when women not only were permitted to be members, but also can be priests of the cult. Though it should be noted, the Dionysiac artists are a theater troupe dedicated to Dionysus, which is distinct and separate from the cults of Dionysus, the latter of which Claudia Tryphaena appears to be a priestess of. Now, ultimately, this is where the historical side of the Dionysiac artist ends. From this point forward, Freemasons pick up on the reports of this group and they just run with it. And it all begins with the best and most reliable source, an anti-Masonic conspiracy. That was sarcasm. I'm really bad at sarcasm. In 1798, John Robison publishes his polemic, Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe. Great title, by the way. Robison was a Scottish physicist that lived in Edinburgh. Following the French Revolution, he became disillusioned with the Enlightenment movement, in particular Enlightenment societies, most notably the Freemasons. Thus, he pens this text, in which he describes the Dionysiacs as undoubtedly an association of architects and engineers that had exclusive privileges to build temples, theaters, and other public works under the tutelage of Dionysus, similar to the trade guilds of the Middle Ages from which Freemasonry comes. He claims they distinguished themselves by maintaining trade secrets from the uninitiated, as well as secret signs of recognition. He further claims that they came to Ionia from Syria and Iran, and prior to that from Persia, and that they would survive to the Middle Ages as guilds. Robison is the first to make any of these claims, and it would appear he was relying on Chisholm and Chandler. One particular piece of evidence for this is that he claims they came from Iran. This may be a misunderstanding of the term Iraqi, in both Chisholm and Chandler's texts, which could likely be conceived of as Iraq, but is most likely just an area of central Turkey. Now, Robinson's polemic likely would have had no influence on Masonry if it were not for one particular coincidence. He lived in the same town as a Scottish Freemason who likely read his polemic and worked the Dionysiac artist into his own history of Freemasonry. Alexander Lowry, a Freemason and contemporary Robinson living in Edinburgh, publishes his The History of Freemasonry, drawn from authentic sources of information, in 1804. This is where the Dionysiac artists truly enter Masonic history, and it introduces a lot of novel content about the group that is totally absent in historical records. Lowry presents himself as following Alice Gellius and Chisholm, though it does not appear he knows Greek, like any dialect of Greek or Latin, or he reads it very poorly, hence his blunders of citing things that appear to be strictly from Chisholm. He probably was following and misrepresenting Chandler and picks up a lot of bogus assertions from Robinson. In fact, he specifically states in his section on the Dionysiac artist, quote, "Dr. Robinson, who will not be suspect of partiality to Freemasons, ascribes their origin to the Dionysian artist. It is impossible, indeed, for any candid inquirer to call into question their identity," end quote. In other words, because Robinson was an anti-Masonic author, why should anyone doubt him about the connection between this Dionysiac artist and the Freemasons? I know, solid argument there. Largely, Lowry copies his citations from Chandler's works. Remember that missing book of Attic Nights I mentioned earlier? Lowry is the one who actually cites it, Book 8 of Attic Nights, and he cites it as if he had read it, though no one knows the content of it, except what can be gleaned from the index. The index mentions a Dionysiac festival, but nothing more can be gathered from the short description from the index. It's difficult to determine if Lowry was ignorant or just plain reckless, as he frequently misrepresents information or outright lies to fit some agenda of his. For instance, he seems to think all ancient mystery cults, be it the cult of Eleusis, or the cult of Bacchus, or the cult of Isis, that they're all the same thing under different names with different modes of expression. Such, in fact, could not be further from the truth. Lowry pulls capriciously from Chisholm by asserting that the two political factions in Taos are, in fact, two lodges. He uses Chisholm's comment about other information and sources to be utensils still used by Masons today, which I mentioned earlier. Then he misrepresents Chandler by claiming that more than just the president presided over the annual gatherings, that the Dionysiac artist, in fact, had masters and wardens. He misconstrues these annual meetings with the artist being entertained rather than they being the entertainers. Then he unfoundedly claims that the more opulent artists provide charity to their poorer brethren. He uses the fact that Chisholm found some of this information on the back of gravestones to mean that the Dionysiac artists built monuments to the memory of their masters and wardens, which so happened to be the burial grounds the Turks would build centuries later. He even makes the bold and totally bogus claim that King Attalus was in fact a member of the organization. Lowry's work is loaded with misrepresentations and faulty representations of source material, fallacious reasoning, and outright falsehoods. Nonetheless, his work more or less creates the myth of the Dionysiac architects and future Masonic writings on the subject by later authors. Now, next in the chain of corruption is the next most influential writer on the group, Hippolito José da Costa. It's also sometimes just called Hippolito Joseph, who produces an essay in 1820 called Sketch for the History of the Dionysian Artificers, a fragment. This is a work that would give academics nightmare, not just due to poor scholarship, but in reasoning and general writing. It is, after all, called a sketch, but it is a marvel that this was produced by a diplomat and a journalist. It is absolutely painful to read, and even worse, to try and digest it. It is so awful that it should not be any wonder that Manly P. Hall was attracted to the work. So much so that he would republish the essay with his own introduction in 1938. It is just a rambling mess of superfluous information and discussions with no academic validity whatsoever. Da Costa spends some 8 pages trying to argue that all mystery cults of antiquity were the same thing, and he argues such with unnecessary and lengthy digressions, then suddenly says something along the lines of, "Well, none of that matters, so let's talk about Greece, lol." He spends an unnecessary amount of time confusing isosapi, gematria, and Kabbalah, supposedly because he thought these were all the same thing. He digresses on so many pointless and inconsequential discussions to his main topic of the Dionysiac artificers that it is not until a whopping 30-some-odd pages into his essay he even begins to discuss them at all. And this document's only like 50 pages long. His citations on the Dionysiac artists lead one to believe he is pulling everything directly from Strabo, though he, like Lowry, is just copying the citations found in Chandler's Ionian Antiquities, so he's probably actually just copying Lowry's citations. He claims the Dionysiac artificers were sent by King Hiram of Tyre to Jerusalem to assist in the construction of King Solomon's temple. DaCosta had spent a considerable amount of ink trying to argue for Apollo's patronage of Byblos, and that may be why he equates the Dionysiac artificers with the Gebelites of Byblos sent by King Hiram. Remember, to DaCosta, Apollo and Dionysus are the same thing. I'm sure Nietzsche would have a thing or two to say about that. And that Phoenicia and Ionia are the same place. Yeah, I don't get it either. His sole proof that a Grecian organization had to have built King Solomon's temple is based on Josephus' claim that the temple was built in a Grecian style of architecture. Likely he's referring to a passage in Antiquities of the Jews where Josephus states the temple was in the Corinthian style. Probably because Josephus thought the two pillars on the front of the temple were similar in style to the Corinthian. Never mind that if an Ionian group of builders were going to do anything, it would be in the Ionic style. Oh, and how does DaCosta explain away the obvious debauchery and licentious behavior of such cults as those of Bacchus and Dionysus? Perverts. That's all. Perverts ruined everything. And as for pagan idolatry and worship of gods, like, oh, I don't know, Dionysus, the very deity this group gets its name? Why, that's the Israelites' fault. Yeah, some of his arguments come across as rather anti-Semitic. Then he goes on to more seemingly superfluous information and digressions of little consequence, until he makes the bold claim that the Essenes were, in fact, the Dionysiac artificers who survived in total secret until the Crusades, when they reemerge as something like today's fraternity of Freemasons. Never mind as to how one can know so much secret history supported by bogus citations and no actual evidence. It would certainly appear that DaCosta was trying to express an incomplete idea that is probably more ambitious than practical or even knowable. DaCosta's work probably only became relevant because he was a notable Freemason. And really, the only reason he's a notable Freemason is because he was arrested and imprisoned by the Portuguese Inquisition for being a Freemason. If it wasn't for any of those things, nobody would have paid attention to this pamphlet. Now, the next author who provides some major leaps in the developing concept of the Dionysiac architects is Robert McCoy. In his General History of Freemasonry, 1870, he becomes the first to call them the Dionysian architects. And this is also, he's the first to claim that they were priests of Dionysus. Never mind that the devotees to Dionysus were largely women, and they were largely governed by women. McCoy states that they were Sidonian builders, which leads one to believe that McCoy did not understand geography very well, nor did he own a globe, as he appears to think Sidon and Byblos are the same, or Sidon and Tyre are the same. Again, I don't get it. He appears to be getting much of his information from DaCosta, as he claims they built King Solomon's temple, that the Dionysiac architects became the Roman Collegia of Architects. No historical evidence exists for such a collegium ever existing. It's also grammatically odd to portray a single college with a plural noun. I always thought that one was funny. Which in turn, McCoy believed became the guild, the corporations, and monopolies of the Middle Ages, because they were monopolies and this gave rise to Freemasonry. Yay! Of course, that vast and complex history can be summed up in a few short sentences. One curious mentioning of the Dionysiac architects I have found is given in a passing reference in the Royal Architect degree by Henry P.H. Bromwell, his Right of Free and Accepted Architects. Bromwell states that Hiram Abiff was their Grand Master in the construction of the temple. As far as I'm aware, Bromwell is the first to make this claim, and the next person to make this claim would be Manly P. Hall. Now, it's highly doubtful Hall ever had access to Bromwell's ritual, much less the patience to decipher it. And even less could he have been a member, as the rite had been dormant for over 40 years by time Hall writes secret teachings. It's likely Bromwell got the inspiration for this passage from Robert McCoy, though it is difficult to ascertain what was inspiring him, as it is literally just a passing mention. One known source of later information on the Dionysiac Architects is Kenneth Mackenzie's Royal Masonic Cyclopedia, 1877. However, I've had some difficulty accessing a copy of this work, so I really cannot comment on it. Next in the timeline is the renowned Albert G. Mackey. As well-respected as Mackey is, he can be extremely problematic academically. Mackey was certainly aware of DaCosta's work, as he discusses the Dionysiac Architects in his encyclopedic entry on DaCosta, which he applauds. Though he does admit the reasoning, quote, may not always carry conviction, end quote. However, his entry on the Dionysiac Architects is largely pulled from Lowry and McCoy. Mackey cites Oliver, George Oliver, I'm presuming, for some of his information, but it would appear Mackey was confusing and he actually intended Robert McCoy, as George Oliver does not write about the Dionysiac artists slash architects, but Oliver's Cyclopedia and Dictionary of Freemasonry was published together with McCoy's General History of Freemasonry, and it is McCoy's General History of Freemasonry that talks about the Dionysiac artists. Now, Mackey follows McCoy in saying that the Dionysiac architects were priests. Mackey is the first to establish a date of their founding, 1000 BCE. This date appears to be based on biblical literalist chronology, which dates the construction of the temple at 1018 BCE. He then pulls directly, almost verbatim, from Lowry, by claiming that the more opulent members provided charity to the poorer members. Like Lowry, Mackey appears to not be fluent in Greek, and he makes some blunders. He claims the lodges were called Oinoikiai, which appears to be a corruption of Oikima, or lodge or house. That's where we get the word economy. Following his sources, Mackey claims they had secret signs or a, quote, universal language to distinguish each other. He, like his predecessors, believed that all mystery cults were the same thing. They're not. Unlike Bromwell, Mackey claims that Hiram Abiff was just a member rather than a Grand Master. Mackey makes a very audacious claim that the Dionysiac architects imparted their secrets to the Israelites, and then subsequently, they were initiated into the Israelite mysteries, whatever those are. Hence Mackey's claim that, quote, the apocryphal legends of the Dionysians would naturally give way to the true legend of the Freemasons, end quote. He even admits this is a speculation, but he claims the statement holds true under the authority of Lowry and Oliver. Again, he means McCoy. Quote, the latter part of this statement, it is admitted, a mere speculation, but one that has met the approval of Lowry, Oliver, and our best writers. End quote. In other words, Mackey is saying, I made this up, so if I'm wrong, then blame these other guys for making me think this. Yeah, he certainly had a way with words. John Weiss's The Obelisk and Freemasonry, 1880, is another work that mentions the Dionysiac architects. He claims he's pulling from Mackenzie, but it's doubtful this is his only source, as he appears to be drawn from Mackey as well. For instance, they were incorporated in 1000 BCE, that Hiram Abiff was a member, etc. He even corrupts the Koine Greek word for lodge even further from Mackey, which likely illustrates that he is also not familiar with Greek. It's almost like this bizarre game of scholastic telephone in which no one knows what any of the words mean or how they're spelled. Weiss is the first to introduce the claim that the Dionysiac architects had a secret means of intercommunication across the globe, which is likely a misunderstanding of Mackey's phrase, universal language, which probably means the secret signs and words of recognition. He's also the first to claim that they built the Temple of Diana, that is Artemis, at Ephesus. Probably because the Dionysiac artists were relocated to that city for some time. He further claims that they worked in Rhodes, Athens, Rome, and Constantinople. And he's the first to make any of these claims. The last in line before Manly P. Hall is Redding Moses in his The Illustrated History of Freemasonry, 1903, who largely cites Mackenzie and Mackey as his source. Now, obviously, by this point, we are looking at several generations of corruption in how the Dionysiac artists became the Dionysiac architects. And alas, we arrive at Manly P. Hall, who seems to be the greatest influence on the dissemination of the myth of the Dionysiac architects, as well as, at the same time, picking from the worst sources of information on them, and of course, by adding his own ideas and concepts to fit whatever agenda he was promoting. It should be noted that when Hall wrote Secret Teachings, 1928, it would still be another 25 years before he would officially become a Freemason, so it becomes a little difficult to assess how well he actually understands Freemasonry. It is my opinion that Manly P. Hall does not understand it very well. Hall does not discuss the Dionysiac architects in a single section, but rather touches on them in three or four different sections throughout his tome. The first time he discusses them, it is almost like an honorable mention at the end of a discussion on the cults of Dionysus at the end of chapter 4. His language is very humble, and he hesitates to authoritatively assert anything. He says that they supposedly built King Solomon's temple, and it is believe that Hiram Abiff was a member. By the time Hall writes chapter 16, he has grown more confident in his claims about the Dionysiac architects. Now he is certain and speaks authoritatively that Hiram Abiff was not only a member, but their grand master. He speaks very mystically and poetically. It's almost a near esoteric verbal masturbation on nothing important in particular for the rest of this section. Then in chapter 40, Hall has gained a great deal of confidence, becomes very assertive and audacious in his claims about this group, most of which is derivative of material that is found in DaCosta's essay. Like DaCosta, Hall runs into the issue of his ambitious claims running into a wall with the fact that there is absolutely no historical evidence for any of this. But he composes his words in such a way that resonate with the writings of conspiracy theorists. Namely, lack of evidence is proof that this secret order existed, because they were so secretive. Further, he cites authors like Charles Heckthorne and his Secret Societies of All Ages and Countries, which is a two-volume tome of not very solid research, in my opinion. In this chapter, Hall claims that Vitruvius, the author of the earliest surviving treatise on architecture, De Architectura, written 23 BCE, that Vitruvius was a member of the Dionysiac architects. His evidence? Because Vitruvius's descriptions of proportions and harmony, as well as theaters, match Hall's conception of what the Dionysiac architects constructed. Huh. I mean, personally, I do not believe Vitruvius would have been a member of an elite cult of architects that built the great monuments of the world. I mean, if he was, he would not have been pandering to Caesar Augustus for commissions so much in the prefaces of each of the 10 books of his treatise. I mean, you look through the preface of every single book in De Architectura, he is constantly pandering to Caesar Augustus, and it's clear he's trying to get commissions. So he wasn't doing well as an architect. Hall also claims that the Dionysiac architects survived long into the Middle Ages, and while still being pagan, they were permitted to construct the cathedrals and other Christian structures. because that totally makes sense. While Hall admits this is unorthodox, he cites the secret symbols of the Dionysiac architects were carved into Notre Dame, but those were destroyed during the French Revolution. How convenient. It should be noted that Folcanelli's Mysteries of the Cathedrals was published 2 years before Secret Teachings was released. I don't think that's a coincidence. Hall eventually, he goes rogue, and he begins to make wild claims with absolutely no historical foundation. For instance, he claims the Dionysiac architects called themselves the Sons of Solomon, and that they used the Seal of Solomon as a symbol of their fraternity. The Seal of Solomon, according to Hall, is the Magnum David, or the Star of David. That is two interlacing triangles, as opposed to the more usual pent alpha, or the pentagram. He claims the Knights Templar had contacted the Dionysiac architects, and the Templars borrowed the symbols and ideas of the Dionysiac architects and spread them into Europe. Never mind that Hall had just stated a few pages ago that the Dionysiac architects did this themselves already. It would be too tedious to comb through every last detail Hall claims about the Dionysiac architects and to dispute them. Needless to say, he spends a lot of ink and page space on ideologies and philosophies, etc., of a secret group no one knew about until about a century or more prior to Secret Teachings. Things so secret and hidden, one has to ask, where did Manly P. Hall discover these most secret secrets? Certainly others have followed Hall and continue to make bogus claims on these Dionysiac architects, and there are likely others that precede Hall that I'm not quite aware of yet. One curious example is the Masters of Tyre degree under the jurisdiction of the Allied Masonic Degrees, which was a very short-lived order that was created in 1930 and then was extinct by 1933, 3 years, which this degree has numerous references to the Dionysiac architects as well as the builders of King Hiram, sends to King Solomon. In fact, it appears that John Shute, who created the order, the Masters of Tyre, that he was pulling almost entirely from several of these sources we have already gone over. However, everything we have just gone over is likely the lineage of how Hall discovered the Dionysiac architects and came to write what he wrote about them. So the Dionysiac architects began as a real group of people known as the Dionysiac artists. They were a traveling band of theater entertainers who were believed to be of low morals and corrupting to the youth. They may have incited an act of sedition that forced them to have to relocate their base of operations. They enter Masonic discourse via an anti-Masonic conspiracy theorist, and through a terrible game of telephone, in bad scholarship, they steadily transform into the most secret and elite organization of architects and engineers, building the great monuments of the world and adhering to the highest morals. And it certainly is quite the transformation. And it's just really weird. And scholastically, a nightmare.
How about that? This was incredible. But also not very surprising. Something that I always look to Masons for is quality in work. However, that almost never translates into quality of scholarship. In fact, there are very few scholars of Masonry today that dig into the real context and historical facts about things from the past. And actually, we still live in a time where, by presenting these things as facts, we still, on occasion, become attacked for destroying something or ruining somebody's conception, concept of how something is, or their romantic view of something, or you're popping a bubble of something that they've built a foundation on. And unfortunately, that happens, and there's really no way to get around it. We don't apologize for it, because all we're doing is stating the truth. And certainly, we try to do that in a way that makes everybody just a more informed, or a better informed, Masonic student, a student of Masonry, a student of the philosophy of Freemasonry. And you just can't do that with a lot of the rampant misinformation that exists. On this podcast, I've read between 2 and 3 papers every single week for 13 years. I'm pretty well read. That doesn't include what I read outside the podcast. If you do the math, it's a lot of Masonic papers. And we've presented on the Dionysian artificers, architects, artists before. And we've certainly read through all of these types of ideas and claims. And now we've got a real foundation of where this comes from. And I believe Worship of Brother Day puts it best when he says it's a bad game of telephone. And we get where we are today. The proliferation of faulty information, the proliferation of something that sounds cool, but is actually based on a misconception or several misconceptions of earlier things. Once again, Worshipful Brother Day rips the veil asunder, and now we are the better informed. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. We'll be back again next week with another exciting edition of the Whence Came You podcast. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast for allowing us to do this. One more thanks out to Worshipful Brother Day for his time and all of his expertise that goes into this. Certainly a passion, and that comes through. If you'd like to join the conversation about the show, and you are somebody who backs this podcast either by PayPal or Patreon, make sure you find the Craftsman Plus Facebook group, and we'll get you all signed in there so that we can chit-chat about anything, really, but mostly subjects that come up in the show. We'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
Yeah.